Good afternoon, this is Aaron Fitzpatrick at The Root of It. Today's sponsor is Edwards in Surrey, Virginia, for smoked hams. Thank you, Edwards. On May 19th today, for the Wine and Week, the Week in Wine recap, we start with news that the 2006 Saint-Emilion classification, scrapped by the French Court Appeal, has been partially reinstated. A law passed on May 13th contained a footnote clarifying that the six chateaux promoted to Grand Cru Classé in 2006, Château Bellefond-Beclair, Destieux, Flair Cardinal, Grand Corbin, Grand Corbin d'Espagne, and Bambousquet, would be able to keep their status with immediate effect and dated back to the date of the classification. The ruling also applies to the two properties which had been promoted to Premier Grand Cru Classé, Pavie-Mecquen and Trappes-Longmondeau. Reuters UK reports spending on high-quality luxury products and fine wines has yet to pick up much and can remain depressed until at least September. Two of the world's biggest luxury goods groups said on Thursday. LVMH, which owns Dom Perignon Champagne, said it had seen some recovery in sales at its wine and spirits unit, particularly for cognac, but April revenues overall were still broadly in line with the first quarter when it saw a drop in like-for-like sales of 7%. American billionaire Stephen Adams is poised to buy his seventh chateau in Bordeaux. Adams already owns six chateaux on the right bank and now has sights on the big one on the left bank's Medoc area, angling for a third or fourth growth. In 2005, he had added Chateau de Bel Air and Lalande de Pomerol to his portfolio, followed by Chateau Lenclos in Pomerol and Chateau Roland in Saint-Emilion in 2007. In New York, Frank Bruni has stepped down from his post as the New York Times restaurant critic. No news yet as to who will succeed him. And for tastings this week, from 12 to 5 p.m., the Wines of Greece tasting is being hosted at the W Hotel on 541 Lexington between 49th and 50th Streets. So just a short while to make it there after the show as it goes from 12 to 5 p.m. And on Thursday, at Veritas Restaurant, Vineyard Brands will be hosting a Red Burgundy preview, 2007 releases from Cluges, Claire, Boyau, Maury, Girardin, and many more. And today's guest at the Root of It is John Priest, who's the chief winemaker of Etude Wines in Napa and Carneros. He will join us after the break, which we will continue our discussion with John Priest then. Here is Vacationing People by Foreign Born. Welcome back to Heritage Radio Network. This is At the Root of It. I'm Aaron Fitzpatrick. And my guest today is John Priest from Etude Wines. We're going to place a quick call to him, and hopefully he's on air now. John, are you there?
I am here. Nice to be here.
Wonderful. Great to hear you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for your time, and we are great fans of your wine. So I wanted to pick up from where we left off in conversation a few months ago. I met John at a Napa Valley Vintners tasting here in New York City, just as the Heritage Radio Network was getting underway. And he was talking to me about a few of the projects that they're working on over at Etude Wines, and some of them very in line with the Heritage and slow food causes. So I wanted to speak to you a bit about the background of the winery there and its nascence. It's young, yes?
Yes, absolutely. I think it was quite fortuitous that we had the opportunity to connect. And we have these efforts, but we feel as though they're very important to our heart and how we like to go about living our lives, but not necessarily something that we put out in the forefront when we're promoting our wine. It's really the ethos of how we do things. So,
sure, it's a lifestyle.
It's really great to have a vehicle to be able to get the word out.
Well, great. Can you tell us a little bit about the start of the winery?
You bet. Etude has been in existence since 1982. It was the brainchild of the founder, Tony Soder, who had made a reputation for himself and really for some very esteemed Napa Valley vineyards back in the 70s and early 80s for Cabernet Sauvignon. So he was very instrumental in really creating a resurgence and a renewed interest in the focus of the Napa Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And he started Etude as really to be a vehicle to explore Pinot Noir, which was a relatively new and fledgling variety in California, although it's a variety that had been in the state for a number of years, really wasn't taken very seriously because there was a great deal to learn about the grape.
Hmm.
So Etude was started really as a vehicle for that. It didn't take long, though, that the impulse to make Cabernet Sauvignon crept in and began making Cabernet as well in the mid-80s.
So your first experimentation with the Pinot Noir was the kind of birth child of the vineyard then?
Yes, it was.
Yeah. And did the Etude, meaning the study of Pinot Noir, does that have anything to do with that?
It certainly does. When you think of what Etude means in a musical sense or a heightened sense of the word, it is really studying the mastercraft. And that's the way we continue to look at this. Every year we're thrown new curveballs by Mother Nature.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's a learning experience. It's a lifetime learning experience. And not only learning, but just practicing that mastercraft. We like to think that we have a good handle on what we're doing, but we're always looking for improvement and always looking for learn. If you lose that quest for knowledge, life gets rather boring, doesn't it?
Sure. Well, the study of wine never seems to get old, at least for
Absolutely
me.
Absolutely not.
So in terms of the wines themselves and the vineyards that they come from, as you mentioned, Etude was the first project, and then you branched out to start making Cabernet Sauvignon shortly thereafter. But the Etude Pinot Noir wines are estate-bottled wines. Is that right?
Yes, they are. And that's actually a relatively new development. Etude, always being very small, relied on the relationships of growers for the Pinot Noir, which was, we still do for the Cabernet.
Okay.
But in 2000, after a long pursuit to really find the perfect spot to represent Carneros and the style of wine that we make in the Carneros region of California, went into an arrangement with a long-standing cattle ranch family that had a beautiful piece of land and allowed us to come in and develop the land so that we could have a home for Pinot Noir. And so 2004 was our very first estate-grown Pinot Noir. It's just wonderful to have a home and be part of this amazing ranch.
That takes a whole other amount of care, I imagine, as well.
I'm sorry, I think I've lost...
Are you still there? Are you still there?
I can barely hear you, I hate to say.
Oh. Let's see if our trusty producers can help out with that. Can you hear me now, John?
Oh, that's much better.
Much better.
Thank you.
Okay. Sorry about that. So I was just mentioning the Pinot Noir, and now as of 2002, it's being estate bottled. That's a whole larger job, in a sense, for your staff and your winemaking facilities? And so did you take on a lot of new staff and land in order to make that happen?
Well, we did. We had to hire our own vineyard manager and a team, a very small team of very dedicated farm workers that that really work full-time on the ranch and know it intimately. Mm-hmm. I work with a viticulturalist as well, and she and I really team up to be the wine growers. Okay. We like to consider ourselves wine growers rather than winemakers.
Okay.
To really sort of explore and understand this the vast myriad of different soil types and microclimates we have across this ranch.
Do you say the term wine grower because your belief that wine is made in the vineyard is more true to that word as opposed to winemaker?
I suppose we like to think of ourselves as being somewhat non-interventionist as mm-hmm. winemakers, mm-hmm. and that to be able to get the attributes that we're really looking for in the wine really has to come directly from the efforts in the vineyard.
Sure.
And particularly in the style of wine that we make, and particularly in the Pinot Noir that's so transparent and so has so much visibility into the terroir and the soil and the climate where you're growing the grapes.
Mm-hmm.
If we really are intent on expressing that to the most highest extent, then we need to be very, very acutely tuned into how we're growing the grapes so we can express that individuality.
Sure. Again, that word that we love, terroir.
Terroir.
Ben, you mentioned
like to say that the potential is made in the vineyard, and we are just here to actualize it in the winery.
Execute, exactly. Yeah. Well, you can taste it in the wines as well. They have a nice balance. They have that good minerality, but light hand on the oak, especially in comparison to a lot of other Pinot Noirs coming out of California and Cabernet Sauvignons especially.
Well, fantastic. Again, mm-hmm. we want to be very, very true to the terroir.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, we need to, you know, step out of the way a little bit as winemakers.
And speaking of the soils, the Pinot Noir is grown on volcanic soil. Is that right?
It is, which is actually quite unique for the Carneros region, which is why we really sought out this particular part of the Appalachian.
Okay.
Most of the Carneros is comprised of uplifted ocean bay bottoms that have receded from the San Francisco Bay. But our little corner is up along two earthquake faults that are at the base of the Sonoma Mountain. And all of that geologic activity has raised this volcanic and very rocky soil. It gives us a little bit different profile.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I think that sets us apart a little bit.
Nice. So that was a very distinct reasoning for going into feeling comfortable with the purchase of this land, especially knowing those qualities existed.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was a very unique opportunity for us, and and it gives us a way to set us apart a little bit and to have the soils that are going to allow us to make the wines in the style that we prefer.
Do you have any neighbors there that also have volcanic soil, or any encroaching neighbors?
No encroaching.
No.
But we're all good friends and compatriots.
Oh, that's good.
The Durrell Vineyard, which has gained some notoriety, is our most adjacent neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a very similar type of profile in the wines that they make as well.
People who've told me that they visited Etude thought it was the most beautiful winery they saw out there. I haven't been yet, so I do look forward to coming.
Well, I'm glad they think so. We're pretty comfortable here. Mm-hmm. We're not flashy, but we like to be, sophisticated yet understated.
And the Cabernet Sauvignon, you do source that. You're continuing to source that from different growers in the region.
Yes, we are. That is essentially the result of some long-term relationships that have begun through Tony Soter when mm-hmm. he began the brand. And we look specifically for vineyards that have some heritage and are along the benchland of the Napa Valley. So as you come off of the mountains, and then before you get into the valley bottom, you have this wonderful, deep, rich benchland soil, which keeps the vines small. You tend to have a great saturation of fruit in the wine, but you also have this wonderful texture of tannin that is really only accomplished when you grow in these vineyards. And the growers that we work with have such a great connection to the land. It's just a real pleasure working with them.
I noticed on your website as well, you...
I think I've lost you one more time.
Okay, I'll try this here. How's that sounding? John.
Hello, Aaron.
Hi, I'm here.
There you go. I hear you. It's a long
Very
ways
strange.
Away for our listeners, all the way across the continent.
Oh, and this is the first sunny day that we've had in a while, so I was thinking that all the connections would be clear.
Sunspots.
Yeah.
Blame it on the sunspots.
Well, just going back quickly before we take a quick break, your website also features these different growers that help you grow the Cabernet Sauvignon. Is that right?
That is, and you'll be able to go in there and get a little small profile of each of them. The Phillips family, the Morisolis, the J.J. Cohn, the Schoensteins, all wonderful people and very connected to the land.
I thought it was interesting and very nice that you chose to do that as well, because I think that there is some misunderstanding for people who don't know wine or don't visit vineyards often, that everything happens at that particular site, whereas there are a lot of other places that help make that wine come together. And this is an opportunity from your wines to showcase those farmers who are helping you maintain the quality.
Absolutely. You know, and it is quite a bit different situation from the grapes that we grow ourselves. You really having this relationship and, you know, the connection that these growers have with the land, and the understanding that they have, particularly some of our growers that have been growing for multiple generations, there's a real story there, and there's a great sense to be able to learn from them when they understand all the experiences they've gone through. And hearing the stories of the frosts of 72 and how they were able to overcome
persevered,
them.
Yeah.
Persevere, it's just wonderful. And, you know, just sitting down and listening to them, I learn a great deal.
Wonderful. Well, we're going to take a quick break and be back with John Priest from Etude Wines in just a minute. Welcome back this afternoon. This is At the Root of It with Aaron Fitzpatrick. We're here today with John Priest from Etude Wines in California, from Carneros and Napa Valley. John is joining us today, and we are going to continue this segment and conversation about his wines and sustainability and difficulties of small production and the triumphs as well. So, John, you here?
I am there.
Okay.
Yes.
We're just back this afternoon, and I wanted to get back to your comments about the involvement that you've had with Slow Food and Heritage. And our conversations when we first met, I was talking to John a little bit, and he mentioned a project that he was doing, a preservation project for the Charbono varietal. Now, as many wine people know, you don't really see that grape so much, especially in 100% varietal.
That's right. Yeah, it's very rare. In fact, I think there's less than 80 acres planted in the entire country.
Wow. And what spawned this movement that you're interested in this?
Well, it actually started from really from the grower's standpoint, not necessarily the grape. But here we have a small set of growers that have been growing the same grapes over multiple generations, essentially carrying on the traditions that their immigrant ancestors brought to this country, and the grape varieties as well. And certainly the fads and the tastes of the American public have changed over the years since these grapes were first planted, when they were meant to be just wines enjoyed around their own table mm-hmm. and their neighbors. But yet there's still a heritage here, and there's a preservation just from the growers themselves. And we call the wines Fortitude, in recognition of all of the hard work and the perseverance, and able to keep these grapes in the family and keep them in the ground. And I think that there really needs to be an honor of that.
Hmm.
And that's essentially, that was the brainchild of this particular project.
And when was the first vintage for Fortitude?
It would have been 2004.
Oh,
and
four.
It started with the Frediani family, who is growing the Charbonneau grape. And they're one of the few in California still have this in the ground. And their grapes go back to 70, 80 years old.
Hmm.
And as far as they can tell, and far as they are concerned, they'll never come out of the ground. They are surrounded by some of the most hallowed and most expensive Cabernet vineyards in Napa Valley. But yet they're holding on to, you know, what their great-grandfather planted.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's just wonderful.
So it's expensive land, but the tradition is being upkept.
No doubt.
Yeah.
And we need to be able to offer these growers a place to sell their grapes.
Sure.
And by us being customers and putting these wines together, it really gives them a place to be able to grow them so that there is an economic incentive to keep them in the ground.
Well, it seems very akin to what Heritage does with the farmers who grow our pigs and meat. So are
Absolutely.
You calling this
I
a Heritage
exactly.
project?
Well, we refer to that to, kind of as the efforts that we put into it. We are calling it Fortitude,
mm-hmm.
and I think Fortitude means a lot of different things to a lot of different people.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an implied heritage to that. A willingness to stand up and against all odds and still be able to persevere.
What is it in the blend? Is it 100% Charbonneau or is it a blend?
It's definitely dominated by Charbonneau.
Mm-hmm.
But back in the day, when these vineyards were planted, they were rarely single vineyard or single varieties. There was always a melange of different varieties planted in an individual vineyard.
Right.
And we've identified Carignan, Petite Syrah, Napa Gamay, and then a myriad of other sort of unknown grapes that have been there for, you know, for 70, 80 years. But it's dominated by Charbonneau.
Oh, I see.
And
so they're all in that same vineyard planting. And what when you harvest, you might get a little bit of the other ones as well, the Gamay, the Carignan.
And that's what makes it unique.
Mm-hmm.
It's clearly to anybody who, you know, for those those few of us that really appreciate the Charbonneau grape, it's clear that that's the dominant variety because of its just dark, inky character and wonderfully bright acidity. That carries through pretty dominantly. But it's those other varieties that I think make this field blend very unique and make it more close to what the original intention of these wines were meant to be.
Mm-hmm.
We've tried to peel back the layers of fad and fashion and think of ourselves in the shoes of the growers and the folks making the wine 80 years ago and what they would like to have presented. And the biggest honor we have is when the Fredianis have this around their table as their table wine.
Yeah.
In their little tumblers. And, you know, then we really, I think, hit at the soul of the heritage.
How many cases or bottles are produced of it, roughly?
Just about 900 to 1,000 cases.
So is this all available direct from vineyard, or is it in distribution with your other wines?
The best place to find it is directly from the winery.
From
on
the
our
winery.
Website.
The website,
yeah.
Yep. Which is what, John?
That's a good question. etudewines.com. www.etudewines.com.
Etude, wines.com.
Correct.
And the word Fortitude, to describe the Charbonneau blend, you also use the word heirloom to describe the Pinot Noir single vineyard blends. Is there a certain range within those?
Well, that was an entirely different ambition, but it has the same type of ethic behind it,
mm-hmm.
In that they are very unique and individual selections of Pinot Noir that have been passed on from vineyard to vineyard over the decades that are not available through a certified nursery system, but really have what we think is heritage and true Pinot Noir character. And we've embarked upon an effort back in the mid-90s, and now most recently at our own vineyard, to library and collect and catalog these selections so that we can have them as a preservation project as well.
Really interesting.
The certified plants that we were able to get through nurseries through the university systems are certainly the core of the industry and very important to us because they allow us a quality that we can count on and reliably. However, these heirloom or heritage selections offer a more unique and individual type of character that we think is true to Pinot Noir and needs to be preserved.
Wonderful. The Pinot Noir craze, you certainly were a pioneer for the Pinot Noir craze from Napa, I assume.
Yes, back in when Etude was started in the early 80s, there were just a handful of people who in California that were embarking on Pinot Noir, and Carnero certainly was one of the areas that helped the grape emerge. It's so great to see, after all these years, Pinot Noir becoming much more accessible and much more recognized.
Yeah.
You know, we're getting a lot more attention these days, and we certainly appreciate that.
Right. And the Cabernet Sauvignon that you also produce and distribute, do you align with one varietal or another as your signature?
Well, it depends on who you ask. There are those that don't even know we make Pinot Noir, and those that don't even know we make Cabernet. So there are almost two sides of our brain.
Sure.
We happen to be in one of the very unique locations in the world where we have world-class Pinot Noir being grown in the Carneros along the cool San Francisco Bay. You just turn left up Napa Valley, and you're in a warmer climate with more appropriate soils and certainly the best place in the world for Cabernet Sauvignon. And we're smack dab in the middle of those two regions. So very unique.
Very unique. And you're using organic methods in the vineyards, sustainable methods, but is there a whole bureaucracy of terminology within those classifications like there is in Europe that you're up against?
There certainly is. I'm so glad you brought it up that way. And we like to really approach the way we are part of the land and our efforts in a very holistic way. Certainly we have certifications that we follow, but oftentimes those certifications are not broad-reaching enough for us. For example, there's nothing that discusses what kind of relationship you have with your neighbors or how it is you preserve and protect the wildlife on your land, or how it is you interact with the nature around you. You know, those are not certifiable, so to speak.
Sure.
That really is at the heart of our ethos and heart of our efforts. So we like to go beyond sort of any certifications that we might be able to collect along the way. Those are very important to us because they are an endorsement. But we see a much broader picture and the effort that we're part of the place where we are, part of the land, part of the earth, and not intending to impose ourselves on it, but to be a partner and to get out as the expression as best possible.
Wonderful. The use of the natural wildlife that you use during harvest time or year-round as part of your natural environment, does that have some sort of biodynamic tone with respect to the moon and then the wildlife utilizing in the vineyard?
I think so. You know, it's just all a rhythm. And like I say, the least impact you can have, the more you can be part of the environment than opposing yourself or imposing yourself on it, you know, the more harmony you're going to have, the more comfort you'll have, and the more expressive the wines will be.
So year to year, you might look at the factors that are going on in the environment and then determine how, when or how to harvest and things like that.
Clearly.
Yeah.
You know, we're ultimately looking at the health of the soil, the health of the surrounding environments, the well-being of the people that work on the vineyard, and our goodwill with our neighbors as well. So it is a very holistic approach.
Well, how was this year's vintage?
Dynamite. Yeah, really, really a fantastic vintage.
Good.
You know, we are blessed in California of having a relatively mild climate.
Right.
And the vintage variations up and down are relatively narrow when you compare them to other growing regions in the world. So we enjoy that.
Yeah.
It makes it a very, very wonderful place to grow grapes and to make wine.
Are there any other projects that you're working on or would like to mention before we close today's show?
Well, it just, I think exploring the nooks and crannies and the different variances that we have out on our state vineyard with the Pinot Noir, mm-hmm. and the collection of the heirloom selections of Pinot Noir that we have, I think is a very significant effort at this point. And of course, maintaining the relationships that we have with our esteemed growers that have so much to teach us. It's really just an ongoing effort.
Great. Well, so appreciate your time. I know that you travel a lot, I imagine, getting the word out and representing your wines as the wine grower, your best to do that. So I know that you're busy, and I really appreciate you joining us today.
I think after this conversation, I'm heading right out to the vineyard because I want to feel that slow rhythm.
I love that. That's the one thing that can draw me away from New York, I have to say, is a winery, a vineyard.
Well, you're welcome anytime, and I hope you and your listeners come and visit us.
Thank you so much. This is John Priest from Etude Wine joining us today at the Heritage Radio Network. Talk to you soon, John. Thank you.
You bet. My pleasure.
Okay. Bye-bye. Join us next Tuesday at 4 p.m. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick signing off from At the Root of It. Thank you again to our sponsor, Edwards. And we're going to close with a song by Tom York called The Clock.